You're listening to Exploring Boys Education, a regular podcast produced by IBSC, examining current issues affecting boys, teachers of boys and boys' schools. I'm Tom Batty, Executive Director of IBSC, and whether a first-timer or a frequent caster, it's a pleasure to welcome you to this episode. In this episode, Bruce Collins, our Director of Membership Engagement, interviews Professor Andrew Martin from the University of New South Wales about the latest IBSC Global Research Report, the role of educators in supporting boys' academic and social-emotional well-being. With participation from more than 40 IBSC schools, this project aims to move beyond theory and pinpoint the specific high-impact practices that maximise a boy's sense of agency, resilience and engagement. Bruce and Andrew's conversation explores an actionable blueprint for your school, focusing on the key strategies educators can adopt immediately. They highlight the practical ways teachers and coaches can operationalise the research findings to build genuine connection and foster lifelong success for every boy. The research report that forms the basis for this conversation is now available free for IBSC members in the IBSC Member Centre. As you will hear, the rigour and intent imposed by Professor Martin on this project reaps evidence practices for improving outcomes for boys. It's been a pleasure to work with Professor Martin. His work will empower and direct teachers and co-curricular leaders in IBSC schools across the globe, and we are sincerely grateful. Before getting underway, a note of a not-to-miss IBSC online event on the 20th of November, facilitated by Sally-Ann Huang, High Master at St Paul's School and IBSC Board of Trustees Vice Chair for UK Europe. Sally-Ann's session will explore the dynamic role of women in leadership at boys' schools. She will review the key academic research that reveals pathways to leadership for women, from selection processes to their experiences in the post. Through these studies, Sally-Ann will examine the hallmarks of success for female leaders and their impact on school culture and student development. This event will benefit current and aspiring female leaders in boys' schools, as well as current school leaders who seek better to understand, support and advance female leadership in this context. So, benefit us all. Visit the IBSC website to register. Now, it's over to Bruce and Andrew.
Thank you, Tom, for that introduction. And from my side, Andrew, welcome to Exploring Boys Education. It's wonderful to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you've just presented online to a number of IBSC members, and I was really blown away again after reading the research reports and also listening to you speak about it. Just wonderful research that I think is going to have huge impact in our community. And it's great to have you on here to highlight some actionable strategies that schools can employ to support well-being. And these strategies, as Tom mentioned, are sourced from your research with IBSC schools. And I would urge everyone, you know, if their appetite is wet in this conversation, to download the research report and other supporting documents that you've provided for us. Those are available on the IBSC website right away. But before we get to those strategies, Andrew, as an educator of boys at heart and having spent many years in boys' schools, I'd like to explore your interest in this topic before we dive into some of those strategies. Your extensive work in this space focuses heavily on student motivation and agency. I'd love to hear what attracted you to this deep investigation into educator practices and boys' well-being within the IBSC community.
I wonder actually if the attraction to this began many decades ago. I remember when I was in year 10 at school, and I was at an all-boys school, And in those days, students didn't go to parent-teacher night. It was just your parents that went, and you sat at home feeling very, very nervous.
Wondering what they were going to come home with, right?
Well, in year 10, what walked through the door that night wasn't pretty. The year master was actually quite surprised that I had any intention to go on to year 11. And so life in the Martin household was not very happy that night. So I wasn't a bad kid. I lacked motivation. I wasn't listening. I wasn't doing much homework. And back at the ripe old age of what, 14 or 15, you don't join the dot. You don't actually connect the fact that if you do no study, you're not going to do very well. So anyway, that night at parent teacher night, the dots were clearly joined, and so that was quite a shock to me because I did plan to go on to year 11 and so on, and I was very fortunate. I was I was in a family and a home and a school where I could, if I decided to do some study, I'd do okay. And so year 11 and 12, I sort of got my act together again. But I know from a young age, I know what it's like to be engaged and I know what it's like to be disengaged. I've been there. And then at uni, I did child psychology in my undergrad, then educational psychology in master's and PhD, and then focusing and funneling into motivation. It always stuck with me as a construct, as a phenomenon that meant a lot to me, if nothing else, through my lived experience as an unmotivated, disengaged schoolboy. And so that research, as I, moved on in university, it was clear there were gender-related patterns in different facets of motivation. There are lessons in there, strengths and opportunities for both boys and girls. But this project was an opportunity to really dive deeply into the boys' side of things, including in single-sex boys' schools. And a chance to draw out major theories of motivation, engagement, and test key constructs in those theories to see which ones really do explain outcomes, academic and social emotional well-being outcomes in boys' lives. So it's a bit of a long-winded, it's a long way to get to this project, but the backdrop is actually quite authentic. This goes way back for me.
I was just marveling as you were speaking to the group that was gathered before we recorded this, about the uniquely rigorous multi-layered methodology across students, exemplary educators, and school leaders that you employed in this study. And it just struck me that this comprehensive design must have given a unique opportunity to dive into and draw out what the educator's independent role in influencing a boy's life is.
Usually, researchers have to go begging to schools, can we get anything from you, please, to do our research project? This was really quite a unique opportunity because IBSC said, hey, we can not only do we want you to, but we can give you access at all these layers and levels, and in so doing, really get a 360 on what supports boys' academic, co-curricular, and social emotional well-being. So from the granular to the whole school, that's what this project involved. And also importantly, it was the order in which we went to these stakeholders in the research project. Often in research, you'll do interviews with school leaders and educators first, identify some of the key strategies they say are important, and then you might build them into a survey that you give to students to see, how do these factors play out in their well-being. We reversed it. We said we're starting with the students, that is where this begins. What are they experiencing? What are they seeing as salient in their well-being? And then when we see out of the mouths of boys what they're saying at scale, I mean, we're talking 17,500 boys responded to this survey. It's possibly the largest survey of boys, certainly of boys in boys' schools ever conducted. And then we followed the boys that is so, you're right, you've said this. Now we see what do educators do to operationalize that. Another key feature of this multi idea of the project is the fact that it's what we call its multivariate nature. And that is we, in the quantitative part, we employed statistical methods that were multivariate. And what that means is you throw a lot of possible teaching support factors into the pot, and statistically you can disentangle which of these is making you the biggest unique difference or effect or impact on boys' well-being. Usually you're limited by sample size. You can't throw too many factors into the pot because you need large samples. For this project, that was not a problem. That we had so many boys in this analysis, we could do a big multivariate model, and in so doing, really tease out what, you know, when we put all the factors, including background attributes, socioeconomic status, language background, prior achievement, family support, when we put those in as well, it then allowed, if we found, as we did, for example, that relational support is significantly associated with boys' well-being, we know that it is, because it is beyond any effect of other teaching support factors, beyond any effect of background attributes. Relational support still cuts through as being a significant predictor, and that was what this multi-layer. What this multi-layer idea, affords us in this sort of research, and then the valid, the rigorous design, and then the valid findings that follow from that.
I love that whole idea that you started with the boys. It just that resonates with me as someone who used to teach in boys' schools, and I know how much boys love the opportunity to have a voice and to share where they're at. So I love that part of the design. And the single most critical factor that was highlighted by those boys was positive belief in students. It was also highly ranked by all adults. And so I'm wondering if we're thinking about in the school context for people who are listening to this podcast, what are non-negotiable daily language or feedback shifts every educator can make right now to communicate this positive belief, especially to boys with whom they interact who are struggling or possibly feel marginalized?
You're right. That kept coming through either as being first or second ranked by any of the stakeholders. And so a key part of that is, in my view, to give all students access to competence and success opportunities. Now we can't force a student to be successful. And so there's that expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. But a wise teacher once pointed out to me when I rolled that line out, she said, no, but you can salt the oats to make it thirsty. And that was an epiphany to me as a researcher and as a parent, I hasten to add. If you force competence and you demand this or that, we find the wheels can fall off. That can raise anxiety, fear of failure, get in the way of relationships. So we can't force, demand a boy succeeds. But we can create conditions and climates where he's prepared to do a little bit more rather than a little bit less. And if he does that every week, week in, week out at school, imagine that positive trajectory from the start of the day he walked into school, day one, to the day he walks out. And so giving students access to competence and success experiences. And so, for example, one way to do that is what we call, for example, process goals. These include things like effort, knowledge building, skill building, understanding, and so on, more than, for example, outcome goals, marks, rank, pecking order. The minute you go to rank and normative assessment and relative assessment, it is a sifting of winners and losers. There is no getting around that. Someone will come second. Half of them will come below. So when you're talking about positive belief in students, if you tether your wagon too much to normative and relative assessment. I recognise it has its place, mark my words, but if we tether it too much, then instantly you relegate some students to failure, for want of a better word. Whereas those process goals, every student can build their knowledge. Every student can try a little harder than they did before. Every student can understand something a little better if they give a little more time. And that's what I mean about giving students greater access to competence and success. No, we can't demand they know it more or understand it more, but we can create conditions and climates where they're prepared to give something a shot. So that's one way of communicating positive belief. Set the conditions and start establishing goals where every boy has a crack at success, even if he may choose not to take that crack at the moment. Another one, and it's related, is this idea of personal best goals. Goal setting and goal striving. Often we associate that with sport and co or extracurricular life, but we've done a lot of research on PBs in the classroom for your academic life. And so seeing your academic and co-curricular life a little more in terms of you being in your own lane and stay focused on that, and your job is to do a little bit better or try a little bit harder than you did before, and being focused a little less on who's in the other lanes. We find even elite athletes deal with the rigor, the blowtorch of brutal competition better when they see their sporting life in terms of PBs. That takes a lot of the heat out of what otherwise would be quite overwhelming for many people. So a personal best approach is another way to communicate that positive belief. It communicates, I believe you can grow. I believe you can improve. I believe you can do a little bit better than you did before. And I believe you can be on a positive trajectory.
And another factor that came through strongly, particularly for educators, was the whole idea of relational support. They ranked it highest, viewing it as a precondition for effective teaching. I know it also ranked significantly in students, but they ranked it last out of the four key kind of themes that came out. I wonder if you have any advice for educators. How can they translate their intrinsic relational warmth into functional explicit support that directly registers with students and as a result then maximizes academic engagement?
This is one of the joys of research, and the joys of capturing different stakeholders and their lens. And so that was an interesting finding where boys were certainly saying relational support is important. It remained as one of the big four teaching support factors. But educators and school leaders were ranking it, were seeing it as a little higher than the boys were seeing it as critical to well-being. We speculated that students, certainly at school students, may see relationships in those more sort of traditional ways. Oh, you have relationships with friends. You have relationships with your mum and dad. And so whereas educators know that relational connection and relational support manifests in teaching and learning life as well. And boys may not have seen that as so clearly. And so the other is that educators may see relationships as being more an implicit part of the process. And so even though relationships are happening, they're not so visible to the students. And so what we suspect is there's no denying the importance of relationships. And so it may mean that educators need to be more explicit and visible in relational support and really drawing a little more attention to that so that boys do know a little better that they are being relationally supported. And so, for example, make a point of showing interest in a student. Be clear that you're interested in knowing more about how that student learns. Be very clear to the student about that. So more than just sort of quietly observing how they learn, being a little more overt and explicit about that, or finding out about a boy's interests and using and being explicitly connecting that to their learning, or is using it as an example in class to switch them on, being clearer about not giving up on a student and saying, no, I have high and positive expectations for you. I'm not going to let you get away with that, with what you've handed in. Let's give it another shot. I know there's more. I know there's more in you. I know there's more petrol in the tank. And so being clear about not giving up. So I think that those are ways, in many ways, doing what you're doing, but perhaps being a little more overt and clear and obviously intentional about the relational support you're providing.
It was interesting for me too that students, when we talk about academic well-being, that they ranked autonomy support highly. I wonder how teachers can use pedagogical frameworks such as the load reduction instruction model to grant students choice and input without causing the frustration, the cognitive frustration that comes from abandonment or insufficient structure, or just feeling lost and unable to even start.
This is where it's helpful to just do a little more reading on what the primary sources and the classics say about autonomy support. It's often misinterpreted as, you know, just release kids to pure discovery or unguided problem or inquiry-based learning before they've learned some of the basics. And that's not what autonomy support is. There is structure, there is scaffolding, there are guardrails in autonomy supportive teaching. The goal of autonomy supporting teaching is to move a student to have agency in their lives. And a lot of quality agency rests on knowing what to do and how to do it. That's where, you know, real agency, where you have true agency in your life, is when you know what to do and you know how to do it. And for us to know that stuff, for human beings to know what to do and how to do it, they need to have it in what we call their long-term memory, so that at a later point in time, they can retrieve that knowledge and how-to and use it. That's when they can do that at any point in time, tomorrow, next week, the week after, in curricular or co-curricular life, we know they've learnt it. It's in their long-term memory. The question is, how do you get it there? We do know that in the initial stages of learning, you do need to break stuff down. You do need to teach stuff clearly. But critically, that's not the end in itself. The goal of that is, once they've got it, you move them on to more independent learning, independent problem solving, so they are truly agentic at that point. And so there is a place for that. So there's another framework in the report that we've got, the I do, we do, you do model, where the I do is the teacher says, all right, all eyes on me, I've got something to say. And then there's the we do. So after the teacher's, introduced an idea or a concept, there's the we do, where there's a bit of Q&A, some interaction and so on. And that's what we call agentic engagement, because the student will say, oh, no, I don't understand this, ma'am, or can you go over that again, or whatever. So that's the first stage of agency, that we do. Then when the teacher's satisfied they've got the basic knowledge and skill, the teacher moves them on to the you do phase, which is very much autonomous, independent problem solving, but only after the teacher's satisfied they know what to do and how to do it first. So autonomy support, the goal of that is to move a student from that more structured early phases, but the goal is to move it. It's a means to the desirable end of agency and autonomy.
I'd like to shift to the co-curricular now, and I love that your research focused on both the classroom and the co-curricular domains. And it was interesting for me that boys valued quality instruction really highly in the co-curricular domain. I think, maybe where they feel like they are novices or don't know everything. And so I wonder if you could share what's possibly the single most important functional strategy a coach or co-curricular leader might employ to quickly build competence and confidence in novel or high-stakes activities.
That's another very interesting finding, because you would think, I want quality instruction in the maths class, or, you know, that's stuff there where there's real intellectual grind and muscle needed in academics, and that's where you want the quality instruction. Of course, the boys reported they did, but it was in the co-curricula that they ranked quality instruction the highest, which was really fascinating. And as we reflected more, we speculated that co-curricular life, a lot of these things are very quite novel, and you know, many schools encourage boys, hey, give something different a shot. You know, try debating, try chess. Cadets, you know, you weren't doing cadets at age five. And so there were these. So co-curric, when you think about it, has so many slices of life that a student likely has never or experienced only to a small degree. So what I'm saying is, in many aspects of co-curricular life, students are novices. And what we do know about novices, getting back to that idea of long-term memory, what do you know and do you know how to do it? They don't have much in the back room of long-term memory. They don't have, and including muscle memory when it comes to sport and so on. And so what we know when you're a novice in the early stages, again, you need things broken down. You need a strategy we call chunking, and co-curricular and extracurricular. You know, sport is an example. They're experts at doing that, breaking skill sets down and so on. So you break it down so it's in bite-sized, manageable bits. There's good support and scaffolding. There's the opportunity to practice and rehearse what you're doing. Then there's some feedback and feed forward from the coach or the instructor or the music tutor about, you know, okay, this your corrective information and this is what you can do next time. That's the feed forward part at the end. And then when they've gone through sort of those first four steps, so breaking it down, scaffolding, practice, feedback, feed forward, you go through that and the coach or the teacher, the instructor says, you know, I think you've got the basics. Now I want you to have a go at this fuller musical piece, or I want you to actually now, you know, this Friday night, you're going to be the first speaker in the debating team and so on. And so that fifth step is where they're released to that more independent practice and problem solving. So these five areas are what we know a novice needs to move from novice status to expert status. And it was fascinating in the extra creep. Now, that's obviously the case in maths and science and drama and so on, you know, and art and economics, of course. But it was interesting. It seemed also to be the case that was highly valued among the boys. Those five areas that I've just mentioned were coming through as quality instruction in co-curric.
If you were speaking to school leaders, you know, what advice would you have for them to build sustainable, measurable educator agency across the institution when it comes to these markers of well-being in a boys' school?
The first thing is, if we go back to what I mentioned earlier, you can lead a horse to water. So leadership is a delicate role. And leaders will know the more they demand and drive, that doesn't go so well with staff. So you can lead a horse to water to come back to drink, but you can salt the oats to make it thirsty. So leaders that create conditions and climates where their staff are prepared to give something a go, where their staff are prepared to do a little bit more rather than a little bit less. It's the same idea. And how do leaders do that? How do leaders create those conditions and climates? Because the other is, it's important for leaders to understand, is behavior change is very, very difficult. It is hard to get a human being to change what they're doing. The reason is that human being is doing what they're doing because they believe actually that for me, that's the best way to do things. So you've got to have a pretty good reason to not do that because you're doing it because that's the thing that's right for you. And that's a major challenge for leadership, to change behavior when the bulk of people are actually fairly convinced that they're doing it the right way, or they're doing the way that suits them. So that's where inspiring staff comes into it, and modeling and showcasing and walking the talk is very important. One of the themes that came out as an example, was knowing students. Those educators that took the time to know students, and know some of the vignettes that came through. I take the time to know two things about every student that's not part of this subject or not part of this class. You know, even where do they live? What's their brother's name? Those sorts of things. Do they like skateboarding or that sort of stuff? And so what was coming through the leader findings was how leaders would encourage and foster and suggest all ways that their staff can get to know boys better. And so, for example, leaders, emphasizing how important it is to capture data and information on students and to have this represented in ways for educators to better know each student. And so that was in different ways. Every student might have a very brief profile on their academic, social, emotional well-being and a side interest or two. Or there might be in the report, some leaders talked about placemats, and for every student there was a placemat, and there was data on each one of them that they could all look at. And so school leaders, making it easy to capture data and information and then profiling it in ways that their staff could then operationalize. And once that placemat or that profile was developed, the school leaders then asked for action in response to each of those profiles. Just one idea that an educator might use. The school leaders would also model and commend and mentor, mentor rather than admonish or criticize. So if they caught overheard a teacher dealing with a boy in a particular way that was not so respectful or relational, they would mentor that educator, and then look for opportunities to commend that educator when they saw evidence that there was a more respectful and relational interaction with that student. And that would cut across not just the educators, but communication to the home, relational language, relational mantras that the leader would emphasize. So one of them was reach before you teach. And so there were this messaging, this culture, this climate that was being cultivated in all the different ways that I would talk about, and often revolving around a central idea. For example, the idea of knowing, and from that, the leader would operationalize a lot of that would direct a lot of traffic in terms of, you know, what would happen in terms of understanding the boys, relational language, communication, home, and so on.
Andrew, I know this conversation is going to whet people's appetite to dive deeper into this report. And I'm so grateful for your time. And in a podcast episode like this, we will never be able to get through everything and focus on everything. And I think you've done such a good job of giving us insights into different parts of the research in this conversation. But I really would like to give you the opportunity to leave folk with one final takeaway. And so, if you could give IBSC educators one core takeaway message, one behavior to focus on starting tomorrow after listening to this episode and also reading your report, what would that one thing be to maximize boys' well-being in their schools?
Getting back to that multivariate design, after we included so many background attributes from socioeconomic status, language background, prior achievement, and so on, including academic difficulties, at-risk status, and also throwing all the teaching support factors into the one pot, through that across the three stakeholders, positive belief in boys, positive belief in students clearly emerged. And so I'm a big believer in doing fewer things better than too many things not so well. So if you're doing fewer things better, a positive belief in boys, a positive belief in students emerged consistently as salient and impactful. And wrapped up in that, high and positive expectations that are attainable, proximal expectations. So you just raise the bar a little bit each time. The big gains will happen through those proximal gains. A belief in students' capacity to grow and clearly communicating that. A strengths-based perspective on boys, not a deficit perspective on boys, a strengths-based perspective on boys. And then providing the support for boys to realise those positive expectations. There'll be some times in a student's life where the teacher or the coach may be the last thread of the safety net at that point. You know, it may be the parents are a little bit sick of him. And other situations and other parts of life, and sometimes that you know the key threads are the teachers or the coach or the music instructor, so staying in boys' orbit throughout their schooling is critical. And while you're in boys' orbit, they will always be receptive to things that you say and do with them. And a key means by which to stay in a boy's orbit is to be positively disposed to him and his capacity for growth. And even if he's not realizing it or demonstrating it right now, clearly communicating that. The things are in place for him to grow, and that you will stick with him through and to that point. Those would be my take homes from this project.
I'd love to speak to you more about this, but we're going to wrap up. Again, thank you so much for not only your time today to share some insight into the research, but the almost 2 years you've spent investing in this project to inform our member schools and educators in our member schools. We are really, really grateful. So thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
The key takeaway from this research is clear. The most impactful strategy is our unwavering positive belief in our boys. As Andrew said, it's about adopting a strengths-based perspective and staying in their orbit, clearly communicating our belief in their capacity to grow. Andrew's research provides such a clear, actionable blueprint, from the I do, we do, you do model for building true agency to the critical need for quality instruction in the co-curricular sphere. To dive into all the actionable strategies discussed today, download the full report, available now and free for all IBSC members in IBSC Member Center. Thank you again for listening. Until next time, keep championing boys' education.